leaving home. In the late summer after graduating from Colby in 1975, my brother Ed and I, aged 20 and 22, decided to go on a spiritual pilgrimage. With small backpacks and large yearnings, we left our parents' home in Massachusetts. I longed to go deeper spiritually, to discover directly the truth of myself, and to understand this life on earth more fully by consciously seeking an escape from the prison of self-consciousness through spiritual discipline. We discovered a book about the life and teachings of Ramana Maharshi, 1875 to 1950, a sage from South India who recommended meditating continually on the question, "Who am I?" as a way of achieving spiritual understanding. This practice is based on the understanding that what we are is not merely a physical body, or feelings, thoughts, or beliefs, and that it is possible to directly experience the truth that we are, which transcends conditioning, delusion, and physical death. We need only inquire as deeply and authentically as possible into this question of who or what we actually are. This was my focus as we traveled across the countryside, going west, perhaps, we thought, to California. After a few weeks, we had gotten as far as Buffalo, and I was feeling the effect of the new experience of meditation and self-inquiry. The deeper I was able to go with this inquiry, the more profoundly I felt my connection with the trees, birds, and people I saw, and the more open I felt to our shared kinship. What is this me exactly that wants always to be protected and fulfilled, I kept asking, and that sees itself as separate? In Buffalo, we decided to head south and not look for any car rides at all, simply walking 15 to 20 miles a day from one little town to the next, entrusting ourselves as completely as possible into the care of the universe. We had no money and stayed mostly on the floors of churches in the towns we passed through, yet food always somehow presented itself to us. I became increasingly convinced of the truth of the teaching to seek first the kingdom of God, for then all else shall be added unto you, as minor miracles unfolded practically every day in the form of fortuitous coincidences and meetings with people who seemed to us to be angels. Ironically, they often thought we were angels. Our security seemed to be our total vulnerability and perhaps the force field of the inquiry on which we focused. I found my heart opening to others and wanting to help them. Sometimes that help was in learning to receive, and other times it was in being generous with our time and energy to help and counsel people who would naturally confide in us and seek our advice. We spent several hours every day sitting quietly, contemplating and inquiring into this seemingly infinite and impossible question, "Who am I?" The question still filled my mind as we walked for hours on end. Why do I think I am in this body only, and not in the body of that person or dog? Like me, they each have self-interest and strive to get what they like and avoid what they dislike. I found myself loosening an old, tight grip on an idea that I am fundamentally separate, and began to see the same I in others. I could look through their eyes, understand their perspective, and feel their feelings. This began to have consequences. At one point, a friendly man directed us to a quaint little summer cabin on a stream where he said we could spend a few quiet days if we wanted to. We walked there and settled in, but there was no food, so we started foraging. We found lots of wild carrots and some cattail roots, neither of which were appetizing, and since there were fishing poles there and I had learned to fish at Camp Challenge, I decided to catch a few fish. It was drizzling, and I put the first fish I caught into my raincoat pocket, confident he would die before too long. When I caught a second fish, I put her into the other pocket. I went back to the cabin to cook supper, quite proud of myself. The cattail roots and wild carrots were cooking, and I went to clean the fish, but to my dismay, they were both still alive and flipping about convulsively. I realized that I was killing them, but they were not dead yet, so the old patterns kicked in, and I grabbed one and slammed him down hard against the floor. Like waking from a nightmare, I could not believe what I was doing. Yet I did not think I could stop. The fish was still alive. Two more times I had to slam him against the floor, and then the other fish as well, before I could clean them, cook them, and we could eat them for dinner. I could feel their terror and pain and the violence I was committing against these unfortunate creatures, and I vowed never to fish again. The self-inquiry worked relentlessly to expose my conditioned behavior and hypocrisy. The old programming that they were just fish completely fell away, and I saw with fresh eyes what was actually happening and how I had entered their world violently and deceitfully with intent to harm. Here I was on a spiritual pilgrimage, trying with all my heart to directly understand the deeper truths of being, yet I was acting contrary to this by first tricking the fish with a lure, hiding a cruel barbed hook, and then killing them. The next day, Ed and I walked on, and though I still knew little about being a vegetarian, I began to think it would be a better, even a necessary, way to live. Walking on the small backcountry roads, we wended our way south through New York and into Pennsylvania, then across Pennsylvania and into West Virginia. Most every evening we would look up a local minister and stay in a church, and sometimes be offered a meal as well. We also stayed in rescue missions, jails, homes, communes, fields, and forests. Thanks to Johnny Appleseed, our little packs were almost always filled with apples, and we would occasionally see abandoned gardens with ripe zucchini. I found myself beginning to minimize eating meat when it was offered, though I worried I might not get enough protein if I refused it completely. Dogs were an occasional threat as we walked along the backcountry roads, I suppose because they would perceive us as strangers invading their territory. One morning as we walked by a house in rural West Virginia, a large German shepherd emerged without barking and walked behind us. I shivered when I suddenly felt his nose touch the back of my leg. We walked many miles and he stayed right with us, a beautiful animal, friendly and energetic, always running before us and acting like our protector. We stopped for lunch on a little hill above the road and ate a few apples, and then meditated for about a half hour, as we usually did. The dog sat quietly with us, looking alertly into the distance and radiating a profound sense of peace and power. We were quite in awe of this dog. He was clearly an accomplished meditator. We continued walking, and coming around a bend in the road, we saw a house on a hill above us, and a large dog who immediately rushed down the hill right at us, looking like he meant business. Our German shepherd friend was at the moment a few hundred yards behind us, and what a thrill it was to see him streaking from behind us, across the hill, and bowling the other charging dog over before he could reach us. After receiving some stern growls, the other dog ran back up to his house, and we three continued on together, enjoying each other's company enormously, until the great dog eventually looked at us, turned, and trotted back toward his home. I wondered how anyone could fail to be touched by the spirit of this being. Yet, if he was kept in a cage, or, as in China, seen only as a piece of meat to be eaten, or, like a coyote or wolf, as a nuisance to be shot, his presence and individuality would be completely invisible. Our long walk south continued through the hills of West Virginia and into eastern Kentucky, and then into Tennessee. People thought we were on an adventure to see the world, but for us it was an inner journey. Meditation and self-inquiry were the focus of every day, always coming back to the present moment and striving to approach cosmic consciousness. I felt certain that more elevated levels of consciousness than the ones I had experienced and saw displayed in people must be potentially available. Spiritual teachers and certain poets spoke clearly and passionately of their existence. As the weeks went on, we gave up one thing after another. Extra shoes and spare clothes were all donated one by one, gradually lightening the load in our backpacks. It felt wonderfully liberating to let go of less physically bulky attachments as well, like the little address book with some friends around the country I thought we could visit on our journey. I discarded it early on in upstate New York, and soon after we gave away a $200 emergency fund we had in the form of $450 bills hidden in our packs. I took my glasses off as well and put them away, which was quite a challenge since my prescription was strong, with 20/400 vision in my better eye. The world was blurry for a few weeks but began clearing up noticeably as my eyes and mind gradually began to recover their natural ability to see again. I began realizing that it was my habit of wearing glasses and contacts that had caused my vision to deteriorate and would have made me a lifelong customer of the optometry industry. Though it was a bit frightening at first to remove those artificial barriers between the world and myself, it became increasingly liberating, and today I haven't worn corrective lenses for over 25 years. As the golden autumn days rolled by and we continued walking south, I began to feel more alive than I ever had before. It was as if layers of armor were peeling away. Waves of pure joy would suddenly sweep over me, and I would feel as if my heart was absolutely bursting with gladness. It was a joy that seemed to have little relation to what I had always thought would bring happiness. We had no money, virtually no possessions, and no idea where the next meal or lodging was coming from. And so why would these unexplainable waves bubble up from within so vividly? One thing was certain. We were living our life, not the life that had been dictated by media images or by parents, teachers, relatives, and authority figures. It was perhaps the essential joy of being that arises spontaneously when we are true to our inner calling to evolve. It seemed to create a field of freedom and blessing around us that was protective and almost palpable. The quest for understanding was everything. We somehow knew not to try to hang on to anything. I remember one Sunday in a small West Virginia town when we were asked to give the morning lesson to the Sunday school children, and we told them that we had found the truth of what Jesus taught us. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and everything else shall be added unto you. Afterward, the church took up a special collection and gave us a surprise gift of $30 as we walked on to the next little town. The following day, after we bought two $5 lunches in a restaurant with a $30 windfall, we gave the waitress the remaining $20 as a tip and walked on again, pockets empty and hearts free. Once, when we had not eaten for quite a while and had nothing at all in our packs, I saw a plastic package up ahead by the side of the road. It was a fresh sandwich. We ate every bite as slowly and thankfully as we could. In all the months of walking, we never went seriously hungry. Seeds of community. Eventually, we were somehow guided to a newly formed commune of about a dozen people in central Kentucky. They greeted us warmly, and we learned they were all vegetarians and were affiliated with the farm in Tennessee. We learned how to cook soybeans and first heard of something called tofu. Our hosts told us they wore vegetarian shoes and tried to minimize the suffering they caused to animals. I had been dimly aware of chickens pecking each other's eyes out in overcrowded factory farm cages, of calves being branded and castrated, and pigs screaming in slaughterhouses, and I had seen the transport trucks filled with cattle, but I knew little of the details, or how to prepare healthy plant-based meals. In an atmosphere of openness and caring, we talked of all these things. We worked and ate together and played and meditated together, and it began to seem absurd and almost barbaric to even consider dining on the flesh of animals. I vowed within myself to be a vegetarian. Soon we were heading south toward the farm in Tennessee, continuing our pilgrimage and our practice. We eventually reached the farm and stayed there several weeks. The experience absolutely sealed my vegetarianism and was worth the months of walking that it took to get there. Close to 1,000 people, mostly living as married couples with kids in self-built homes, had created a community on a large piece of beautifully rolling farm and forest land. People wore their hair long as a statement for naturalness and against the military mindset that had been ravaging Vietnam. It was set up legally as a monastery, and it was strictly vegan to avoid harming animals, people, and the environment. The farm had its own school, telephone system, soy dairy, publishing and printing company, rock band, Sunday morning church service, and Plenty, a blossoming outreach program that provided vegan food and healthcare services both in Central America and in the ghettos of North America. Stephen Gaskin, the spiritual leader, was a student of Zen Master Suzuki Roshi, founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. The food was delicious, the atmosphere unlike anything I had ever experienced. People were friendly, energetic, bright, and there was a powerful sense of purpose, of working to create a better world, of sharing together and honoring each other and the local community. The soy dairy made tofu, soy milk, soy burgers, and ice bean, the first soy ice cream, and the schoolhouse for the children served all vegan meals. The kids, vegan from birth, grew tall, strong, and healthy. Gardens, fields, and greenhouses provided food for everyone, and people worked on different crews, building, repairing, cooking, teaching, farming, and together making the farm remarkably self-reliant. I worked in the book printing house, taking copies of the farm's extremely popular spiritual midwifery guide off the press. Women came from all over the country to the farm's spiritual birthing center to have their babies delivered by the farm's experienced and loving midwives. Women who were thinking of having abortions were told that if they had the baby at the farm and decided not to keep the child, then he or she would be adopted by one of the couples on the farm. Though many women came with this option in mind, never did a woman decide not to keep a baby after having gone through the birth process with the farm's caring midwives. I was deeply touched by the loving attentiveness people showed each other and by the courage the whole community displayed in running almost completely contrary to the values of the larger society. The people there, like myself, had all been raised in a culture of domination that killed and abused animals for food, clothing, entertainment, and research, and that emphasized competition, private property, consumerism, and limited liability for large corporations. We had been raised to view the earth, animals, and even people as commodities to be used by the market for self-centered profit. The farm was a living example of veganism, emphasizing gentleness, compassion, and respect for all creatures, a life of voluntary simplicity and appropriate technology, sharing resources and finding happiness through strong, healthy family and social relationships, helping others, spiritual growth, and creative expression, rather than through personal aggrandizement. To me, it seemed these people were going much farther toward actually living the teachings espoused by Jesus than mainstream religions were. The lived ideal was that all life is sacred, and the attempt was to consciously create a community and lifestyle that reflected this ideal and would be an inspiration to others and a model for sustainable living. Needless to say, banking, corporate, and governmental institutions were all extremely hostile to the farm. Though it is still going strong, it's smaller and somewhat less radical than it was in its heyday in the 1970s and early 80s. Though we seriously considered joining the farm, we eventually received intuitive guidance to walk farther south to Huntsville, Alabama. When we got there, we discovered the local Zen Center, where we could devote our energy to meditation practice, sitting about 8 hours daily, and helping with the upkeep of the center. This was a perfect situation for us, and we were able to focus on our meditation practice and receive excellent instruction and guidance. Over the next several years, I continued living in Buddhist meditation centers in Atlanta and then in San Francisco, but loosened up somewhat on my vegan diet since most of the people at these centers ate eggs and dairy products, and I was at that point unaware of the extent of the cruelty involved in these foods. In 1980, while I was living at Kagyu Drodin Kunchab, of Vajrayana Tibetan Buddhist Meditation Center in San Francisco, I had the auspicious opportunity to meet the Dalai Lama and present to him a translation of an ancient Tibetan practice text I had worked on and helped our center publish. Earlier in the day, the Dalai Lama had conducted a ceremony with us in which we all took the Bodhisattva vow, which is considered the foundation of Vajrayana meditation practice, the vow to attain complete spiritual enlightenment in order to be of maximum benefit to living beings. A difficult inconsistency for me and for many others was that while we were vegetarians, many of the Tibetan lamas we sought instruction from ate meat regularly. Even the Dalai Lama himself, while strongly condemning hunting and all forms of animal abuse and encouraging vegetarianism among both the Tibetan people and Western Buddhist practitioners, was eating animal flesh every other day, purportedly on the advice of physicians. Perhaps the reasons may have been political as well, because as the highest and most visible religious authority in the Tibetan tradition, it would take considerable courage to depart from the practice of most of the lamas and follow the ethical vegetarianism enjoined by the original Buddhist teachings. Fortunately, in April 2005, he displayed this remarkable political courage, and news services reported, quote, saying he has recently turned to a vegetarian diet, the Dalai Lama called on people to stop killing and destroying animals, end quote. Because of the Dalai Lama's eminence as an exemplar of peace, this is good news for all of us, and there are encouraging signs that young Tibetans in India are moving in the same direction also. Songguangsa Temple. In 1984, I had my second opportunity to live in a vegan community. This time it was an ancient Zen monastery in South Korea. I traveled there and participated as a monk in the summer's three-month intensive retreat. We rose at 2:40 a.m. to begin the day of meditation, practicing silence and simplicity, and eating vegan meals of rice, soup, vegetables, and occasional tofu, and retiring after the evening meditation at 9 p.m. The meals were eaten in silence, with each of us using a set of four bowls, three for the rice, soup, and vegetables, and the fourth for tea, which we used to clean our bowls and then drink, so that not even a single grain of rice would go to waste. The community consisted of about 70 monks, with some lay people who helped with certain tasks, and the vegan roots there were old and deep. For many centuries in that temple, people had lived the same way, meditating and living a life of nonviolence. There was no silk or any leather in the clothing, and though I was there in the summer mosquito season, it was absolutely not an option to kill a mosquito or any creature. We simply used a mosquito net in the meditation hall. Through the months of silence and meditation, sitting still for seemingly endless hours, a deep and joyful feeling emerged within, a sense of solidarity with all life and of becoming more sensitive to the energy of situations. When after 4 months I returned to the bustle of American life, I felt a profound shift had occurred and the vegetarianism I'd been practicing for about 9 years transformed spontaneously and naturally into veganism with roots that felt as if they extended to the center of my heart. Until then, I had mistakenly thought that my daily vegan purchases of food, clothing, and so forth were my personal choices, simply options. Now I could clearly see that not treating animals as commodities was not an option or a choice, for animals simply are not commodities. It would be as unthinkable to eat or wear or justify abusing an animal as it would be to eat or wear or justify abusing a human. The profound relief and empowerment of completely realizing and understanding this in my heart has been enriching beyond words. When I returned from Korea, I was able to begin teaching humanities and philosophy courses at a college in the San Francisco Bay Area through connections I'd made when getting a master's degree at San Francisco State University just prior to going to Korea. After about 6 months of teaching, I decided to apply for entrance into a PhD program in the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Education. For this, I was required to take an aptitude test, the graduate record examination, and it was interesting that when the results came back, they were very high. Mensa told me that the scores corresponded to an IQ that was in the top 0.25% of the population. In my younger years as an omnivore and non-meditator, I had never scored particularly high on such tests, but it's quite understandable. A vegan way of eating not only allows our system to run much cleaner, but more essentially, it frees us mentally to make connections. This ability is the foundation of intelligence. Regular meditative silence allows our mind to relax and connect with wellsprings of intuitive potential that also seem to increase our ability to make connections. Following a vegan diet and practicing inner silence is a powerful combination. I found, for example, that I was able to teach a full load of courses at the college and simultaneously take a full course load at Berkeley, so that I was typically juggling 8 to 10 courses at once. Not only did the teaching go wonderfully well, but I had only A's and a couple of A-pluses in over 60 units of doctoral coursework, and my dissertation, The Role of Intuition in Education, was nominated for the Best Dissertation Award. There is nothing for me personally to be proud of or take credit for in this, because it's just one of countless human illustrations of the underlying principle that all of us have an enormous potential that can be fulfilled as we understand and live in accordance with our intrinsic nature. The main hindrance to this is the inherited food-enforced mentality of competition and exclusion that keeps us distracted, paralyzed, and unable to make meaningful connections. After teaching college for about 6 years and enjoying it immensely, I felt guided to take up an itinerant lifestyle, giving concerts of original piano music and seminars on developing intuition. Though the college offered me a salary increase to stay on, I felt a strong calling to return to the open road. I had found that in the years since embarking on my pilgrimage from New England, uplifting and swirling new music had begun pouring through me on the piano. And as I focused more on the music and played publicly, it got stronger and was received with enthusiasm. Through the music, I felt my heart and inner vision opening to an inspiring spiritual energy that connected me with the earth and with the plight of both animals and our human family. The music, emerging from the mystery of inner stillness, has always seemed to be a vehicle for carrying elevating and healing energy and intuitive understanding. Although I hadn't been consciously aware of it at the time, while I was switching to a plant-based diet at the farm in 1975, thousands of miles away in Switzerland, a young painter named Madeline was simultaneously making a similar change. In 1990, while playing concerts in Europe, I met Madeline fortuitously in a small Swiss village, and since then I have been wonderfully blessed with her presence as my life partner and loving companion. The power of community. The communities we grow up in and call home affect us all profoundly. Understanding this, we can see why we view animals as commodities and often find it difficult to switch to a vegan diet and lifestyle. Our culture is completely saturated and defined by the exploitation of animals for food. While cultures tend naturally to replicate themselves, they can and do evolve, or may be forced to change by outside pressure. The spread of the herding culture from Central Asia into the Mediterranean and the Middle East, and from there to Europe, took several millennia and was accomplished by physical force, domination of women, and indoctrination of children, as Eisler documents in The Chalice and the Blade. Jeremy Rifkin's Beyond Beef documents how the cattle culture came to North America from Europe, and how European, especially British, demand for beef and its enormous financial and American cattle ranching supplied the capital that propelled our young country and its economy. Lynn Jacobs' Waste of the West documents the virtually complete decimation of Western grazing lands and the near eradication of Indians, bison, prairie dogs, wolves, and all non-livestock, quote, nuisance animals. To this day, federal and state agencies like the USDA's Wildlife Services still poison, shoot, den, and trap millions of animals every year, including coyotes, bobcats, mustangs, prairie dogs, bison, beaver, raccoons, blackbirds, badgers, and bears. It is a tragedy involving unspeakable suffering. While I was in Korea, I marveled at beautiful terraced rice paddies nestled in valleys and climbing up hillsides, efficiently raising enough rice to feed the Korean people who, unlike in the U.S., could actually be seen every day in the paddies tending the crops. With U.S. and European capital investment, however, Korean culture was changing, and American food corporations and U.S. television programs and advertising were invading, creating demand for Western luxury foods, especially beef. Texas cattlemen were traveling to Korea, taking the opportunity to show investors how to convert rice paddies to cattle feedlots. Instead of feeding many people with rice, an area of land would now feed only a few rich people with beef and raise the price of rice beyond what poor people could afford, while creating the environmental nightmare of waste and pollution that modern animal agriculture always brings. The spread of the herding culture into Korea has received a strong boost from the Christian missionaries who have established a considerable presence there. It may be slowed down by the Buddhist monasteries and their teachings and example of compassion and veganism, but only to the degree they remain respected and relevant to the lives of an increasingly pressured population. The spread of the herding culture has been going on for centuries and continues unabated today. Its wealth and willingness to use both financial pressure and physical violence make it difficult to resist, and as it spreads, so do oppression, inequality, violence, competition, and struggle. It is a culture of exploitation and predation that reinforces in all its members its core practice of herding and eating commodified animals. To exist within the hostile environment of the herding culture, vegan communities must be strong and committed. Most, like the farm and Sungwangsa Zen Temple, are essentially spiritual communities. Their practice of vegan living is part of a larger orientation of spiritual practice emphasizing compassionate living, cultivation of inner peace and harmony, and contributing to the moral regeneration of humanity. However, vegan community can also be experienced in many other places today, making the switch to veganism easier and more natural. The number of vegetarian and vegan communities is growing as a result of the proliferation of non-Western spiritual traditions here. There are a growing number of healing centers and religious retreat centers as well, emphasizing vegetarianism or veganism for reasons of both health and spiritual purification. There are also temporary communities, like animal rights and vegetarian conferences, as well as local vegetarian societies that provide knowledge and inspiration. Community support of some kind is vital, for it provides the context, examples, and practical guidance that are particularly essential in the beginning stages of switching to a more cruelty-free diet and lifestyle. Seeds bear fruit after their kind. Both the farm and Sungwangsa Temple are the blossoming of seeds planted by wise and compassionate people at least 2,500 years ago and nurtured and replanted by countless dedicated people for centuries, often in the face of great adversity. The future generations of both humans and animals are depending on us to do what we can to nurture the seeds of nonviolence, intelligence, and compassion in our shared cultural garden so that they can inherit an earth that is healthy and a way of living that is based on freedom and caring. We can each be a field of freedom, and by the force of our example and intention, we make it easier for those around us to do the same. The field will grow, spreading through our culture as a benevolent revolution. While the journey I've been relating here is obviously unique, as all our individual journeys are, I believe the underlying pattern is universal. We have all been born into a herding culture that commodifies animals, and we have all been affected by the cruelty, violence, and predatory competitiveness that our meals require and that our culture embodies. We've also been taught to be loyal to our culture and relatively uncritical of it, to disconnect from the monumental horror we needlessly perpetuate, and to be oblivious to the disastrous effects this has on every level of our shared and private lives. We are all presented with the same evidence and hear the same call for mercy and justice. Within us lie seeds of awakening and compassion that may be already sprouting. Our individual journeys of transformation and spiritual evolution call us to question who and what we've been told we and others are, to discover and cultivate the seeds of insights and clarity within us, and to realize the connections we've been taught to ignore. As we do this, and as our web of journeys interweaves within our culture, cross-fertilizing and planting seeds, we can continue the transformation that is now well underway and transcend the obsolete old paradigm that generates cycles of violence. When we uproot exclusion and domination from our plates, seeds of compassion can finally freely blossom, and this process depends primarily on us watering the seeds and fully contributing our unique journey. We depend on each other, and as we free the beings we call animals, we will regain our freedom. Loving them, we will learn to love each other and be fully loved.